Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida Democrats are keeping their eyes on the race to the White House this year and the race to the Florida Governor's Mansion in 2018.
And in 2 years, we will have the opportunity to take back the Governor's Mansion.
Also this week, America has never been closer to having a woman in its highest political office, and the next governing generation of Floridians is watching.
I can do anything as a career and not just be narrowed down to these few careers that are supposedly what women are supposed to do.
We'll also learn how even the most solemn judicial canons can't seem to keep down and dirty politics out of judges' races in Florida, and we'll visit the grand opening of the first legal marijuana dispensary in the state. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida has a big role to play in the upcoming presidential election and beyond, and as Lynn Hatter reports, while the state's televised presence during the Democratic National Convention may have been limited, the state is still expected to keep its role as a national political player.
Florida's presence on the big stage during the Democratic National Convention was more muted this year. That's partly due to the resignation of state Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz as DNC chair. But the state had some televised representation. Wednesday, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum stepped up to the mic.
Hello, my fellow Democrats. And hello, my fellow Floridians. In case y'all needed a reminder, Florida is in the House.
Gillum is viewed as a rising star in the party, and he's also an early supporter of Hillary Clinton, with his sights set beyond Tallahassee. Earlier this year, he considered running for Congress in a newly redrawn District 5, only to pull back, making way for former state Senator Al Lawson to challenge Corinne Brown. Gillum made the most of his time on the DNC stage, throwing shade at Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump.
You know what, y'all? The world can seem scary enough without so-called leaders leading with fear for political gain.
Oh, say can you see by the...
Also standing in the spotlight was Tallahassee's own Star Swain, whose impromptu version of the national anthem at the Lincoln Memorial went viral. Democrats invited her to perform at their convention. Swain got a standing ovation from the crowd, but most of the Florida action took place behind the scenes. During delegation breakfasts, Congresswoman Gwen Graham, Tampa Mayor Bob Buckhorn, and Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine addressed the crowd. All are seen as potential gubernatorial candidates in 2018, and Graham alluded to that race in her address.
We have the ability to elect a new legislature this year with great young voices like my friend Lauren Book. And in 2 years, we will have the opportunity to take back the governor's mansion. We're going to have to fight.
State Senator-elect Lauren Book, daughter of Florida lobbyist Ron Book, pushed support for Clinton.
Perhaps it's because 2020 marks the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. And you want a woman who has spent her entire career fighting for women, children and families in the White House, not a Trumpster who loses sexism, disrespect, and disregard for women and their worth.
There are many options, other ways she could become president without winning Florida. Ohio and Pennsylvania are going to be critical for her as well. But for Donald Trump, it's an absolute must-win. If he loses Florida, he cannot win the presidency.
Pinellas County's Ramsey McLaughlin served as deputy whip of the delegation. So while Florida may not have been center stage at the convention, its influence in the race to the White House can't be ignored. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
While this week was a big one for Democrats, it turned out to be big trouble for one particular Democrat and, by extension, made for a rocky start for the Florida delegation. Regan McCarthy reports.
News about leaked Democratic National Committee emails came just before the party's convention. The emails included messages from party chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz showing favoritism for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Wasserman Schultz, a Florida congresswoman, agreed to step down from her position as party chair, but hoped to help unite her home state behind the party's candidate. She attended a Florida delegate breakfast at the convention Monday.
It's so wonderful to be able to be here with my home state. All right, everybody, now settle down. Everybody settle down, please.
Despite the jeers, Wasserman Schultz continued, reminding Florida voters of the role they played in helping to get President Barack Obama elected. Bernie Sanders supporters can be heard in the background yelling shame as Wasserman Schultz goes on to say she wants to continue serving Floridians.
I thank President Obama for the honor of serving as the chair of the Democratic National Committee and being able to watch his back and bring him across the finish line in 2012, which we did on the shoulders of Florida's voters. Didn't we, Florida Democrats? Yes, we sure did. And we have made sure that we could continue to build our economy. And we must...
Wasserman Schultz has resigned as DNC chair and is now facing a tough re-election fight at home. Her opponent, Democrat Tim Canova, is backed by Senator Bernie Sanders. He sees the unrest as a potential opening.
It certainly seems like sentiment, public opinion, has shifted quite dramatically.
Meanwhile, leaders in the Democratic Party are working to redirect the focus. FBI officials have said it is likely Russia is behind the DNC's leaked emails, and the Democratic Congressional Committee says it's been hacked, too. Some Democrats have said that's because Russia is backing Donald Trump for president. U.S. Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida says he believes it's possible the country's president, Vladimir Putin, is behind the leak.
Former KGB, he loves to get in and disrupt. So, of course, he could.
And Nelson says that could pose a threat the U.S. may need to answer. But Nelson maintains he doesn't anticipate the leak will have much of an impact on the election's outcome.
It may have worked in the sense that it showed that people have opinions in the DNC, but beyond that, it's not going to affect the outcome of the election.
Meanwhile, Sanders is urging unity. He paid a surprise visit to Florida delegates the day after Wasserman Schultz gave her speech.
Now, whether you supported me or you supported Secretary Clinton, we all know what our task is, and that is to make sure that Donald Trump is not elected president of the United States.
Sanders told the group of Floridians, Republicans don't win elections, Democrats lose them. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still, despite all the kerfluffle regarding the leaked DNC emails and the Wasserman Schultz resignation, the fact remains that Hillary Clinton is now the first female presidential nominee of a major American political party. Kate Payne looks at how her historic run could impact Florida's next governing generation.
Say what you want about Hillary Clinton's politics. Her rise as the first female presidential nominee is historic. And for women of a certain age, the prospect of a madam president is a big deal. Take 102-year-old Arizona delegate Jerry Emmett, who was born before women were allowed to vote. CNN caught her nomination during the roll call of states at the Democratic National Convention.
And 51 votes for the next president of the United States of America, Hillary Rodham Clinton!
For younger generations, the achievement doesn't necessarily carry the same weight. For many millennials, it's not a question of if a woman could be president, it's only a matter of when. Nonetheless, the next generation is taking notes, says University of South Florida political science professor Susan McManus.
But has it been a spark to young women thinking about a political career, whether it's Democrat or Republican? You bet.
The idea that a girl can be president, that a boy can have a female role model, is powerful, even for those who aren't aspiring politicians.
It makes me feel like I can do anything as a career and not just be narrowed down to these few careers that are supposedly what women are supposed to do.
I think it's pretty cool, but at the same time, women shouldn't be forced into the position of, voting for her just because she is a woman.
It gives you kind of a rush of adrenaline, this just feeling in your chest that you know that you can do anything now, and no one can tell you no for once.
That was Paige Carey, Marissa Ponder, and Emma Bryson, all between 11 and 13 years old and aspiring scientists. They're pretty excited about a female president, but statistically, girls are less likely to pursue leadership positions. Researchers point to a confidence gap, saying girls tend to undersell their abilities.
Boys will apply for positions, including positions of leadership, certain job postings, even if they are only about half or more qualified, whereas women tend to apply for positions only if they see themselves as 100% qualified.
That's Florida State University education policy professor Laura Perez Felkner. She studies the social factors behind underrepresentation and why minorities make the career and educational choices they do.
On the whole, women tend to be more reluctant to go for positions of power, positions in leadership, as well as positions where they are underrepresented.
And the research shows that representation, simply seeing someone like you in positions of power, is very important.
People can dream in a more realistic, vivid color. And even if there are things that set them back along the way, there's still a bit more realism attached to the possibility.
Political scientist Susan McManus is studying just how many women are jumping into Florida politics, and she says a female presidential candidate makes a difference.
We've already seen a rise in the candidacies of women, whether it's for state legislative or congressional posts or for local posts.
Equal representation is about so much more than gender, and the prospect of a female president won't fix inequality overnight, but it builds a pathway for generations to come. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Still to come on Capitol Report, do you know about Canon 7 of the Code of Judicial Conduct? It's supposed to keep election campaigns for the bench on the plain vanilla side, but nothing seems to separate politics from intrigue.
What stuck in my mind from when I was in your seat was a judge telling me you have to respect the canons enough to lose an election.
We'll get an update on technical violations committed by probationers and a law that seeks to address that.
Do we want to get to the punishment in a way that everybody agrees to that's effective and fair, or do we want to waste time and judicial resources to get to probably where we would end up initially if we just accepted the sanction?
And Florida's first cannabis dispensary is open, and company leaders hope it can serve a long-standing need among some of Florida's patients. In contrast to the often mean and nasty anything-goes politics of so many national political races, contests for judges are constrained by very strict and strictly enforced codes of conduct. In Tallahassee, a race for county judge is already generating an Elections Commission complaint and anonymous dumps of opposition research. In rural Jasper, meanwhile, a judge faces suspension for running as an anti-abortion conservative. There are the latest examples of the pitfalls of Canon 7, the guidelines that say judicial races should be plain vanilla. We get that story from Jim Ash.
Not long after the yard signs for a Tallahassee County Judge race sprouted like dandelions, a confidential Elections Commission complaint and an opposition research report landed anonymously in local newsrooms. It would be typical mudslinging in any other campaign, but in a judicial race, it appeared to push the boundaries of ethics laws. Chief Circuit Judge Jonathan Jostrom warned judicial candidates at a recent workshop on Canon 7 to treat their opponents like colleagues.
What stuck in my mind from when I was in your seat was a judge telling me you have to respect the canons enough to lose an election. And that's really sort of the point that I want to make with you is that our authority begins with your willingness to accept those constraints.
The elections complaint is filed against candidate Monique Richardson. It quibbles with the paid-for by disclosure language she uses in her ads. The mysterious opposition research file takes issue with a portion of her resume dating back to 1998. If it was designed to cause a media stir, it failed. Richardson declined to be interviewed for this story. She was at the Canon 7 workshop where Florida Bar Board of Governors expert Bill Davis warned candidates not to let their campaign managers go too far.
You need to raise their consciousness that this is not one of those down and dirty kind of campaigns that they might have seen going on somewhere for some other kind of office.
Richardson's opponent, Leon County Judge Lane Smith, was also at the workshop. He denies having anything to do with the anonymous file. Smith says he knows the attorney who filed the elections complaint, but Smith says he didn't urge him to file it. While he says he doesn't want to criticize Richardson, he says she should have known better.
I do get the concern if somebody says I'm not doing it right or anybody else is not doing it right, that if you're running for judge, you ought to get it right. I mean, so nobody wants to be in a position where, say, if you're running for judge, you're not going to follow the law yourself.
Smith was appointed by Governor Rick Scott 2 years ago when his predecessor was forced off the bench for violating judicial ethics. Before he became a judge, Smith was general counsel for the State Department of Business and Professional Regulation. He also worked for the Florida Lottery. He says Canon 7 gives candidates enough leeway to tout their experience, but not much else.
They want you to be a politician from the standpoint that you have a contested race. It's not a yes-no vote. It's not a plebiscite. And yet there are so many things you can't do that any other candidate could do.
For example, Smith says, other candidates can ask supporters directly for money. But not all of Smith's colleagues are as cautious. The Judicial Qualifications Commission is recommending a Lafayette County circuit judge be suspended for 3 months without pay. Commissioners say Circuit Judge Andrew Decker touted his anti-abortion conservatism on the campaign trail. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
The number of people returning to prison based on technical probation violations has contributed to an uptick in this year's new prison admissions. As Sasha Cordner reports, looking for solutions to that problem came up during this year's legislative session and is a priority for the head of the Florida Department of Corrections.
The good news is Florida's prison population is just under 100,000, a bit lower than predicted.
The estimated population for June 2016 was 99,270, whereas the actual population was 99,119, for a negative 0.2% error.
But Matthew Hasbrook says the reason the predictions were a bit off when it came to new prison admissions was due to what's called technical violations. He focuses on criminal justice issues within the state's Office of Economic and Demographic Research.
If you look at the new commitments, where we had an estimate of 29,404, the actual new commitments for fiscal year 15-16 were 29,635 for a 0.8% error. So the error in new commitments weren't as high as for total admissions. Now, this was due to an uptick in the conditional and control release offenders that returned to prison with technical violations.
So what's considered a technical violation? During this past legislative session, incoming Senate President Joe Negron had a few examples.
If you look at the new commitments, where we had an estimate of 29,404, the actual new commitments for fiscal year 15-16 were 29,635 for a 0.8% error. So the error in new commitments weren't as high as for total admissions. Now, this was due to an uptick in the conditional and control release offenders that returned to prison with technical violations.
At the time, some Florida lawmakers weren't too happy about sending former offenders back to prison on minor infractions, so they decided to do something about it. Dover Republican Representative Ross Spano was one of them.
In 2012, the Department of Corrections implemented a new alternative sanctioning program to reduce recidivism through collaboration between courts, probation officers, and law enforcement. And the program has now been adopted in 12 counties within six judicial circuits. This bill would codify that alternative sanction program to give a framework for each circuit to adopt the program if the chief judge in that circuit so chooses. Essentially, the program allows the chief judge of the circuit, in consultation with the state attorney, public defender, and Department of Corrections, to establish the program to address these technical violations.
Spano said his bill would not only reduce the prisoner population, but it could also speed up the court process for those probationers who otherwise could be awaiting a hearing while behind bars. He added there are other advantages as well.
Technical violation, failure to appear on time for appointment with a probation officer. An example of a sanction in that instance would be more frequent reporting. So instead of reporting once a month, you would report three times a month or once a week. That would be an example of one of the types of sanctions. So they differ.
Spano's bill passed both the House and Senate, and Governor Rick Scott signed it into law. And Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Julie Jones says she's very proud of the new law that just took effect, as it was one of her top legislative priorities.
We think it's going to be an important move to start to reduce technical violations for probationers coming back to prison, keep them in community where they can continue to earn a job, have a paycheck, pay victim restitution, pay back the cost to the court, be with their families, and be closer to the end game for them, to keep them in community and keep them from violating again.
But the alternative sanctioning program is voluntary, and under the new law, a judge also has the discretion to reject the lesser penalty. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Well, what had been Florida's somewhat remote worries about the Zika virus have finally turned into a big, scary reality. In the middle of the state's typically hot, humid, buggy summer, Governor Rick Scott announced today that four Zika cases in South Florida were likely caused by mosquito bites. Florida has seen a steady increase in Zika diagnoses in recent months, with the total number of cases nearing 400. But until today, health officials said cases stem from people who were infected because of travel to places such as South America, where the virus emerged last year. Public health officials have worried for months that the virus, which is particularly dangerous to pregnant women and can cause severe birth defects, would become mosquito-borne in Florida. The state last week began investigating two potential non-travel-related cases in Miami-Dade and Broward counties. That was followed by two more cases this week. Most public health officials acknowledge the state's doing about as much as it can, but they say federal health would certainly ramp up the response considerably, especially when it comes to local mosquito control efforts. To date, Congress has been at an impasse in authorizing funding to deal with Zika. Governor Scott and State Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam today announced a series of steps aimed at reducing the potential for mosquito bites and preventing the spread of the disease through blood. In part, Scott said he directed the State Department of Health to contract with commercial pest control companies to increase spraying and to take other steps to reduce mosquitoes in the targeted area of Miami-Dade. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, we end this Capitol Report on a high note. Okay, admittedly, bad word choice. The state's first medical marijuana dispensary opened this week in Tallahassee. After 2 years of waiting, patients throughout Florida will be able to get the drug. But Nick Evans reports there are some new challenges ahead.
Dallas, you going to introduce yourself?
My name is Dallas Nagin. I thank you for the hope of getting better.
This week, Dallas Nagy, wheelchair-bound, sat patiently as Trulieve opened its doors. At the counter, he clutched $60 in cash, tightly. as camera shutters clicked. Nagy's been waiting for this for a long time. Some might say too long. But when the moment finally came and the dispensary manager took his money, Nagy couldn't help cracking a joke.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
No problem.
Woo. Where's my stuff?
The ribbon cutting at Trulieve isn't historic. Patients can already get medical marijuana in 24 other states. A 25th joins the bunch in September. Four of them now allow recreational marijuana, and another four have similar measures on this November's ballot. But all the same, for Florida's patients, the dispensary makes good on a promise 2 years old. And for George Hackney, the nurseryman who's behind Trulieve, it's an unexpected venture.
So 30 years ago, could you have ever imagined that you would
No,
be...
absolutely not, you know.
State law limited eligible growers to nurseries in operation for 30 years or more. But Hackney says at first he didn't jump at the opportunity. It took conversations with family members who work in oncology, cancer, before he decided to make a bid for one of the state's first five licenses.
It seems like everybody you talk to has got a family member who could have benefited from medical cannabis at some point in time, you know, but it wasn't available for him. So, and once it was announced in the news that we were selected, I got a very nice handwritten letter from a former minister of ours congratulating me, telling me, you know, how wonderful it was and how his daughter had been through cancer and how much it would have helped her. So that things like that really make me...
Under the state's current system, patients are limited to people with chronic seizures or terminal illnesses. So the dispensary caters to a number of different routes of administration. But most start with oil.
So it's an extraction process similar to vanilla.
That's Trulieve's chief operating officer, Jason Purnell. He says they soak the buds in ethyl alcohol, Everclear, until the active compounds dissolve.
So that we leave the green matter behind. Okay. So once we remove the green matter, then we dissolve the ethyl alcohol out through a general distillation process. And so it evaporates all the ethyl alcohol. It's food grade ethyl alcohol. And what's left is the oil. And so that oil, the CBD oil or the THC oil, that's an ingredient. And that's an ingredient that we use in all of our products.
Trulieve is planning to open 10 to 12 stores throughout the state over the next year. Another dispensary, Surterra, will begin home delivery in days. And they're planning to open a Tampa storefront within a month. But the dispensary's optimism is tempered somewhat by new hurdles rushing up to meet them.
One of the biggest bottlenecks has been research.
That's Richard Blau, a lawyer specializing in regulated industries. With marijuana federally classified as a Schedule I drug, Blau says research funding in the U.S. has been scarce. And without research, doctors may be reluctant to go through the education and registration process Florida requires to order the treatment for their patients.
As for the doctors who would be in a position to refer qualifying patients, it has been a slow process, but I think you're beginning to see an acceleration.
While dispensaries and activists encourage doctors to get on the Compassionate Use Registry, they're also eyeing this November's medical marijuana ballot initiative. If Florida voters approve the measure, the scope of eligible patients could expand greatly, including people suffering from a number of other debilitating conditions. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.